From the Sunshine State, this is Tampa Bay's TAN Talk.
Next on Reboot Your Life, how humor is saving lives using theater off-Broadway and beyond.
Plus, we speak with a military sniper turned intuitive life coach who's now an expert in abundance.
It's next.
From Riverside Recovery, it's Reboot Your Life. Experience the ultimate reboot of your journey. Start anew and rediscover you. Transform your story. Rewrite your life. It's Reboot Your Life with Carrie Harrison and Ashley Neal.
From Riverside Recovery Studios in Tampa, Florida, Carrie Harrison with you along with Ashley Neal. And thanks for listening to Reboot Your Life, where we help you get back the life you love. Well, Ashley, you were telling me all about Dave Clawson, the mastermind behind the DJC Solutions. And we're going to share his story today with a heart for uniting others. That's his heart, all in the pursuit of a life of abundance. And he's made a name for himself as a speaker, as an author, as a coach, a veteran, and a facilitator.
Yeah, and Dave also possesses highly specialized abilities, having been selected for a sniper team in the past. Dave is now a motivational speaker who helps people discover the inner strength that they need to achieve professional success, increase their time freedom, and experience the jump out of the bed feeling each morning. Wow, I need some of that.
I haven't jumped out of a bed. Well, let me think. But and a former sniper. I love it. So we're talking about acute skill sets. Yeah. And for Dave, the most important thing is to listen carefully so that he can figure out what's causing your problems. Imagine that. And how to help you overcome them. Dave Clawson, we want to welcome you to Reboot Your Life.
Hey, thank you very much. It is an honor to be here. I'm excited to have a conversation with you both.
Well, you're a guy who was with the Illinois National Guard. You were picked as a sniper because you can see, think, analyze, think quickly, imagine. And all of that stuff creates a history where then you have a journey, whatever that journey is, of personal transformation yourself. Because to be a good coach, to be a good anything, you have to actually know about it. So what was that moment where you pivoted?
Ooh, it was actually a series of several small moments throughout life after my year-long deployment to Iraq, in that I had some struggles. I had an undiagnosed traumatic brain injury, and I was struggling with post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety, and depression, which then cascaded into addiction, alcohol. And as I began to learn more about my struggles, the fact that my drinking habits had taken over my identity, I wasn't happy. And so I started learning and trying to figure out what I could do to change. And so it was a series of small events. Really, though, the biggest one, and I'll tell a quick little story here. I was sitting on my couch in my one-bedroom apartment, and I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I realized I needed to get back to being who I truly was on the inside, because alcohol, addiction, my struggles had taken me so far away from that person. I took out my journal and I just did a brain dump and just started writing and writing and trying to unearth who I actually was. So then I could get busy getting back to being that person. So that's really the biggest moment where I started to flex my personal development muscles.
Dave, you talk a lot about your inner warrior. I think we all have one, or yes, we hope we all have one anyway. Your inner warrior, however, helped you overcome struggles with the PTSD you just talked about and substance use disorder. How did you access that inner warrior?
Yes, so I really pulled from post-traumatic growth. I was a good soldier. And so I looked internally to try to uncover the positive. What were some of those characteristics, those strengths, those things that made me a good soldier? And how could I apply those same strengths to my transformation, to my healing, and to my growth? We've all got that. We've all got our inner strengths. We just got to look for them.
And how do you help people find those? Because that's part of what you do as a coach. So we're not taught in school, you know, why don't you just, we favor your other leg if you broke the left one. But that inner warrior is that part of us that is full of light and imagination and passion and all the rest of it. And a lot of people haven't met theirs yet, have they?
No, they have not. The art of self-reflection and almost call it self-discovery doesn't really come easy because it takes time to sit down and be present with your own thoughts and to probe and explore your curiosities to really learn who you truly are, because then you're going to be freed up to then become that person and even craft who you want to become, to map out a plan. And you really do that through storytelling, through listening, through empathy and curiosity.
One of the things that we look at in recovery, we find that there is an entire universe of veterans who have been left by the wayside for decades. Let's just admit it. And now finally, they're getting some love, some light, some acknowledgement, whether it's the VA, or whether it's rehabs like Riverside Recovery that is really focused on opening the doors, even offering their campus for free once a month for all kinds of collective activities. And so this is a giant population in the United States. I mean, let's face it, anybody maybe over the age of 70 or 80 was in the military involuntarily, and then the rest of the people are, but we all come back with some kind of issues. And that said, the military in many ways shaped your approach to coaching. At least this is one of the things that we read and hear and learn about you. And maybe how did that discipline translate into what you're doing now to help others?
Ooh, yes, indeed. So my military service, and actually, quite frankly, my childhood helped shape and mold and forge me into the man I am today, and those strengths that carried me through my healing, my transformation, because my dad is a retired sergeant major, an airborne ranger, served in Vietnam. One of those individuals you were just talking about there. But I really look to leverage my discipline in that sticking to routines, that mission-oriented, that mission-focused, crafting a very clear, compelling vision and mission, mapping out a plan on how to accomplish that mission, and then also looking to the supports, what resources, what tools, what partners am I going to need to help me accomplish this mission? Even as a sniper, I had a team, not just there with me on location on those missions, but I also had response teams, support teams, folks I could call on if I got in a jam as well. And that same approach to healing, to transformation and working with others is to figure out what else do you need to help you succeed and then call on them when you need to.
Dave, do you think you would have the same type of advice for a civilian? Because as a civilian myself, I don't necessarily have a lot of the same experience with having a mission, being mission driven. Would you share some of the same tips with civilians, or do you think they're different?
Yes. So we could change the wording or the lingo out of the military lingo of, you know, the op order, a sit rep, the OODA loop, and all that fun stuff. But it's still the same process. It's really looking inward. Explore and uncover what are your strengths, and then mapping out a plan tailored to in alignment with your individual strengths, creating that vision, that goal of what you want to accomplish and you want to achieve.
Dave Clausen, you, one, I have never talked to a sniper before, so I'm still kind of basking in that afterglow here.
I'm just Dave.
I know you are. Dave the Sniper, I'm sure some of your friends call you. Can you share a pivotal moment, try saying that 10 times fast, a pivotal moment that led to your realization about the importance of resilience and self-awareness?
Yes. So it really comes back to that big moment on my couch, in that I was reading the book Braving the Wilderness by Brené Brown. And that was when the light bulb went off that the answers are within me, and that the resilience that I needed was there. The strength that I needed was there. I simply had to brave the wilderness within and go find it and call it forth. And then I pair that with a quote from my good friend and colleague, Dr. Jeff Linkenbach, who says, "The positive exists and is worth growing." You simply have to look for it. It's there. It's there because we are all born resilient. From day one, we are resilient. We are strong. We simply forget about it. We overlook it. We don't see our inner strength, our resiliency. But when you hit pause, you reflect and you think about some of the challenges that you've overcome, you'll realize you have a resiliency toolbox already at your disposal.
I was thinking about a previous episode with a guest that we just had recently. We were talking about resilience and she said, you know what? Like, I appreciate being resilient, but I'm just kind of tired of being resilient. Do you find that there is some burnout per se with the resiliency because it feels like you always do have to be strong and you always do have to pull up your bootstraps? Is there anything to be said for just kind of letting go of that sometimes as well?
Yes. So I'd kind of run a parallel in that when I think about resilience, it tends to be, as folks talk about it, more reactive. But just like self-care, we tend to think about it as reactive self-care. Oh, I'm burnt out. I'm stressed. I need to unplug. I need to recharge. But I like to shift things and say, what have you thought about resilience and self-care in a preventative manner? Just like exercising, fitness, the more you exercise, the better in shape you are, the lower the limited impact walking up those 12 flights of stairs will have on you as well. And so think of it as a protective, a preventative measure to do in advance before you're in the mess of it.
Yeah, great point. Thank you.
We're talking to Dave Clawson, an established speaker, an author, a coach, a veteran, former sniper, and facilitator with a passion for linking arms with others who want to live an abundant life. Dave overcame significant challenges, including a traumatic brain injury, PTSD, and now empowers others to live with passion and purpose by sharing his own transformation journey and inner warrior skill sets. We're going to talk in just a second with Dave and find out about how to get that abundant life, because if that isn't the plot of the play for every live human being, nothing is. It's straight ahead on Reboot Your Life.
Are you familiar with Riverside Recovery of Tampa? Well, they offer a profound, all-embracing approach to addiction treatment. With a dedicated team of empathetic professionals, Riverside Recovery is committed to guiding individuals on their path to enduring recovery, using a variety of science-backed therapies, counseling, and support services. Riverside Recovery values the individuality of every recovery journey. Their tailored treatment plans respond to the specific needs, the hurdles, the goals of each resident, providing effective aid regardless of whether you're taking your first steps in recovery or maintaining your progress. With Riverside, recovery isn't just achievable, it's an influential journey towards a healthier, brighter future. The testimonials of those who've undergone treatment there are evidence of rediscovered self-worth and potential. Located on the tranquil Hillsborough River of Tampa, Riverside serves as a peaceful haven, promoting self-discovery and healing. They acknowledge that recovery is about more than just overcoming difficulties. It's also about finding your innate strength and resilience. The Riverside Recovery's committed team are your empathetic allies in your recovery journey. They comprehend that genuine healing involves the mind, the body, and the spirit, meticulously dealing with all facets of addiction. You can discover more at rrtampa.com. That's rrtampa.com. Or reach out at 1-800-871-5440. That's 800-871-5440. 800-871-5440 or rrtampa.com.
You can tweet us anytime on X at Reboot Your Life.
Life 2.0. It's your life and your reboot. It's Reboot Your Life with Carrie Harrison and Ashley Neal.
Reboot Your Life with Carrie Harrison and Ashley Neal. We're talking to Dave Clawson. He's really a superstar in this arena as a coach, but also having had such a powerful history that he has brought forward into the future and is helping tens of thousands of people change and reboot their lives and most importantly, find abundance, because that's kind of the plot of the play here. If you can have a better, fuller life, then all of this hard work goes somewhere. Dave Clawson, maybe you could elaborate a little bit on your passion for linking arms, as you say, with others and helping them have that abundant life.
Oh, yes, indeed. So I get very, very fired up in that together is better. And the more we share our own stories, the more we can inspire hope in others, the more we can help folks understand that they are not alone, that maybe there is somebody else that's gone through a similar struggle. There's some life lessons, some things to do, some things maybe not to do, that we can learn from each other to really get one step closer to having that abundant, happy, joy-filled life.
Dave Clawson, you talk about listening to others. Now, let's face it, in our culture anyway, here with the 380 million Americans, we're not exactly taught in kindergarten. Just please listen to your friends. It's like, listen to the teacher. That's it. And your craft is teaching people how to listen to each other, because that's how you learn their stories. And let's face it, what is school? It's books filled with stories. But it doesn't occur to us that each of us has a story that we can learn from. You're reminding us of what we knew when we lived in caves 40,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. Within those stories, our lives, there's wisdom in just your day-to-day life, not just those big pivotal moments, the big Super Bowl, so to speak. But in everyday life, how you show up, how you interact with the others, there's wisdom, there's insights, there's experiences and stories there that can help others as well.
Dave, what is a story that you can share with us that you think will inspire people?
Ooh, yes. So I was having a coaching session with an individual who, he felt stuck. And he was just going through the motions in his J-O-B, his job. And he felt this pull of, you know, trying to be, you know, one with the guys, yet he's a middle manager position and wanting to be, you know, a leader, and that trying to balance these roles had taken him so far away from who he was at the core. He was being who he thought he was supposed to be. And in chatting with him and looking inward to really uncover who he was as a person, he looked and was like, the man I want to be has always been here. I haven't been being that person. I just need to step up and start being me again. Something as simple as that, to help him live a more authentic, real life. And by doing so, he can feel that sense of fulfillment, that authenticity, and that joy, that not putting on a face and being what other people think he needed to be.
You know, it's a delicate tap dance, because in our culture, we're taught, be yourself, be authentic, but don't be yourself and don't be authentic. Be what I've hired you to be. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yep.
So we're all dealing with this. Yeah, but. And so you found a way to walk that line so that they can actually have real integrity, but not wipe out some dumb boss's notion of who they ought to be. Mm-hmm. Like, that is a nuanced skill set, mm-hmm. like being a sniper.
Yes, very nuanced, very precise. And really, it comes from my own personal journey, in that when I came home from my deployment, I felt like I had to put on a face, because I wanted to fit in. I didn't want people to judge me, because I thought I was broken and an outcast and a whole bunch of stigma. And after years of putting on that face and not being happy, not being me, I got tired of it. And that just affected all aspects of my life. And so learning how to be Dave, what is being Dave on a random Tuesday look like? How do I show up? Who do I want to be? And that, you know, I can say something, Ashley can say something, you can say something, Carrie, exact same words. But because we're all unique individuals, it's going to come across different. So it's finding how to host a podcast in the Dave way, or in the Ashley way, or in the Carrie way. it's okay to be authentic. It's okay to be you and still professional and do our jobs.
Yeah. And you're also on the radio, so you're blasting through people's windshields while they're driving, cigarette hanging out of their mouth. It's exciting times for all of us.
Yes. So
here's part two of that question, because you can be yourself, you can have that individuality, but not everyone's going to love it. And this is the part where we learn in life that being yourself is worth it. I mean, this is Plato. This is Socrates. Find out who you are. Peel back the end. Bill Shakespeare, to thine own self be true. So this is kind of a human imperative, but not everyone loves it. So you have to figure out, where do I end? Where does the other person begin? And I imagine you teach people that too.
Yes, I do. We really explore sort of a three-prong or three-step approach in that first, it's really uncovering who you are at the core, your authentic self. Then from that, we craft a vision of who do you want to be? Then from there, once we know that as our foundation in our coaching sessions, we can then get to work figuring out what you want to achieve and then how you're going to achieve it. Oftentimes we come up with the what I want to accomplish, my goal, without really figuring out who we are, who we want to be, our foundation. And so when we accomplish that goal, we're out of sync, we're out of alignment, we're not happy. And so that's the real start, the real process to showing up as your authentic self. And in crafting that what, we have a conversation. It's pretty clear to see, who do you want to surround yourself with? Are they going to be helping you get there? Are they going to be supporting you on that journey towards accomplishing that goal, that what, being that person? Or are they going to be taking you away from being that person that you want to be?
You know, Ashley pointed out earlier, she asked about civilians, what can you teach them and all of that. I imagine that when you get fellow veterans, it's a different kind of coaching and coursework you're offering, because you know what they've been through. It's not like my poodle died, you know, it's hot today, I had to wear a lighter shirt. I'm doing the vanilla version of what people mm-hmm. go through. Mm-hmm. But, you know, some guy comes back having seen the worst of the worst that we know of, you're not going to jump in the same way. I think it helps you having that kind of history for them to relate and trust you, because you have to trust your coach as you would in soccer, in baseball, or anything else. If you trust your coach, you're going to be open to the messaging.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. And what I do is I lead with vulnerability, in that I share my vulnerabilities to create that safe space, to let folks know that, yeah, we've all been through some stuff and we've got to talk about it if we want to heal, if we want to work on it. And so that's really the first step that I take in creating that safe space to be able to foster and build trust, with the asterisk, the caveat of, it's not meant to compare war stories, to one-up each other. It's simply to connect on that emotional level of, we've been through some trauma and we're here to chat together about it alongside each other so we can support each other.
Well, I don't know about you, Carrie, but I mean, Dave, you can just put the invoice in the mail. I feel like I had a coaching session. I feel like I blacked out for a second because I was so like into what you were saying. And I was
good,
like,
thing this is recorded.
Yeah. You gotta hire Dave. Yeah.
She is spot on. And we want to thank you, my friend, for joining us today on Reboot Your Life.
Thank you for being who you are. And thank you for doing what you do. It's been an honor.
Are you familiar with Riverside Recovery of Tampa? Well, they offer a profound, all-embracing approach to addiction treatment. With a dedicated team of empathetic professionals, Riverside Recovery is committed to guiding individuals on their path to enduring recovery, using a variety of science-backed therapies, counseling, and support services. Riverside Recovery values the individuality of every recovery journey. Their tailored treatment plans respond to the specific needs, the hurdles, the goals of each resident, providing effective aid regardless of whether you're taking your first steps in recovery or maintaining your progress. With Riverside, recovery isn't just achievable, it's an influential journey towards a healthier, brighter future. The testimonials of those who've undergone treatment there are evidence of rediscovered self-worth and potential. Located on the tranquil Hillsborough River of Tampa, Riverside serves as a peaceful haven, promoting self-discovery and healing. They acknowledge that recovery is about more than just overcoming difficulties. It's also about finding your innate strength and resilience. The Riverside Recovery's committed team are your empathetic allies in your recovery journey. They comprehend that genuine healing involves the mind, the body, and the spirit, meticulously dealing with all facets of addiction. You can discover more at rrtampa.com. That's rrtampa.com. Or reach out at 1-800-871-5440. That's 800-871-5440. 800-871-5440 or rrtampa.com.
And from the Riverside Recovery Studios in Tampa, Florida, Carrie Harrison with you along with Ashley Neal. And thanks for listening to Reboot Your Life, where we help you get back to life you love.
Make sure you subscribe to our podcast wherever you listen. Each week, you'll get new episodes both on the radio and every streaming platform. You can also check out our videos at rebootyourlifeshow.com.
Well, he's a director, an advocate, and a person in long-term recovery, currently spearheading the Recovery Project at Florida Studio Theater.
As a creator of the off-Broadway play, The White Chip, Sean Daniels shed light on the struggles of alcohol addiction, something we know affects at least one in 10 Americans.
The White Chip has producers like Emmy and Tony winner John Larroquette, Hank Azaria, Tony winner Anna Lee Ashford. And today we delve into Sean's journey, his experiences, and his mission to use entertainment as a tool for change. Welcome, Sean Daniels, to Reboot Your Life.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
We're just so that you know, Ashley has been talking you up in advance. She's such a huge fan. I already am. I love what you're doing. This is such a novel way to get it done. You've been instrumental in using theater to destigmatize addiction. This is something we all wish would have happened forever ago. You're doing it now. Can you share with our listeners how art and comedy can be powerful tools in this journey of recovery?
Sure. So, in addition to doing the Recovery Project, I also run the anti-stigma program for Live Tampa Bay, which is the goal is like, how do we try to get people to just destigmatize talking about getting help, figuring out how they can reach out to other people? And I feel like the arts are the most underutilized way that people can change any narrative. We talk a lot about how national narratives change. There's a great example. Barack Obama, when he ran for president, was against gay marriage. And you can't say what he said back then, even in the great state of Florida as a Democrat, and run for city council, right? So in 20 years, national narratives have changed. We collectively believe different things. And so there were all these studies done about how, like, why is it that 20 years later, we collectively accept different things? And the answer was the arts. The answer was the TV that you watch, the books that you read, mm-hmm. Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, Ellen comes out, Modern Family. Next thing you know, narratives have changed. Some people feel differently. My mother believes she has more gay friends than she has 20 years ago. That's not true. It's just that it's a different place at a different time than it was then. And so we want to do the same thing for addiction. We want to, for this disease that has been named the disease, right, since the 50s, to be able to change the narrative so that people can get help, people can reach out to others. I always talk about how my family, where we have alcoholism and skin cancer all through our family. So we talk about skin cancer all the time. You know, it comes up, everyone gets a dermatologist. If you have a mole, like, whip that thing out at Thanksgiving and we'll all look at it. But when it comes to alcoholism, we don't. We're like every other family. We just kind of like whisper. We just like whisper about an uncle who we're glad didn't show up for Thanksgiving, right? Like, even we internalize the stigma about it. So part of our goal is to really make sure that people have the same conversations around addiction that they do around every disease.
Sean, you mentioned your mom, and I know that you have a connection with your mom. You both achieved sobriety on the same day, about a year apart, which is an amazing connection to have. How has this part of your journey, which is your journey, influenced your perspective on recovery?
So in 2011, I was suicidal. I was, you know, like so many people that have struggled. I had, my wife had left me. I'd driven headfirst into a telephone pole. I'd been fired. And I just really thought it had been so long since anyone had smiled to see me coming. And so I was going to take my life, but instead of doing it, I called my mother, who at the time we did not get along with, we didn't really speak, but for some reason, I just knew that she would answer. And it was the 1 year anniversary of her coming home and getting her 1 year chip. She had been sober for 1 year. So she got me through that evening. She got me to a facility in Jacksonville, Florida. And so till this day, October 12th is both of our sobriety dates. So every year she gives me her chip from the year before that she's got, and we pass it on that way. And we always joke that if one of us goes out, then they have to wait the whole next year to come back around so they can keep the date, which I think like civilians don't find that funny. They find it kind of horrific, but I feel like people in recovery get the significance of it. And so it's really been a gift. And so part of the play that I wrote, The White Chip, that had all these wonderful producers and we hope continues to have a life, is also a bit of a love letter to my mother, because even though, you know, we always have our challenges, in this moment, you really saved my life. And we all know that addiction is a family disease. And for mine, it doesn't even skip a generation. We are straight up the family tree of how it is. And we hope to break, you know, that kind of generational trauma that happens over and over again.
Sean, my mother came to the facility I was in. They had family day. She wasn't planning on taking that trip, but they invited her and really recommended it. And so she showed up with her vodka bottle in her suitcase.
Nice.
And to visit me. And my sister, my twin sister or twister, did an intervention on my mother. And along with the staff, who's ever seen anything like that? It didn't quite take, but it was very interesting. And my relationship with my mother, let's just say, was unclose, using an Orwell term. It sounds like your relationship with your mother at the time wasn't as close either.
Well, I mean, we didn't get along at all. I mean, the fact that she had a 1 year sober anniversary, and actually my brother went with her to get her 1 year chip. The fact that I didn't know any of this was happening shows just kind of, you know, at the height of our addiction, how obsessed we are with ourselves and what's going on and, you know, feeling bad for ourselves. And so I didn't know any of that. And so it was a real shock. And so actually I learned, you know, because when your kid calls and they're suicidal, you just get them through that evening. And so actually I learned at family day, maybe slightly different from yours, because she came to visit me in rehab also. And I didn't know they had invited her and she showed up and why was she there? And then when we had to go around the circle and say what our sobriety date was, I said that it was October 12th. And then she gasped because that's hers too. And we hadn't even realized in the commotion of just getting me through the evening and getting a plane ticket and what rehab takes, your insurance, you know, all that excitement that happens around trying to get somebody help, that of course we would have the same sobriety date if it stuck there.
We're talking to Sean Daniels, playwright, recovering addict who uses comedy on stage to tackle addiction and stigma. He shares his journey from alcoholism to sobriety through his play, The White Chip, and directs the Recovery Project at Florida Studio Theater. He's aiming to change the narrative and is changing the narrative around recovery using the power of arts. You can learn more at SeanDaniels.com. And Sean, you mentioned science in many of these places because there are lots of different ways that people find recovery. Science as a higher power in your play. You say that science is a higher power. How has this perspective influenced your recovery and your approach to addiction?
So what really hit it off for me was I found this group of men that were obsessed with science. And so when we first time I got together with them, they said, like, right, sit down. Here's how it works. There's dopamine. There's neural pathways there. You know, this is what happens. This is what your brain looks like on 5 days of sobriety. This is what your brain looks like on 90 days of sobriety. And for me, you know, I had been through a lot of Kentucky court ordered AA meetings and I'd been to rehab and no one had ever talked to me about science. It had always been about, you know, kind of like pulling yourself up by your bootstraps or about like, you know, you just have to be as honest as you can. And that's what it's going to be. And I just felt like, oh my God, I'm not going to make it. Like, I'm real. I can't actually do it. And the first time that it wasn't shame and weakness, and it was just that this is a chemical thing. And I know this now, right? Because now we're all in it, that 40 to 60% of whether someone's going to become addicted to something is genetic. I mean, that's a huge amount. I feel like we would lead with that information. That feels like important to get out there at the beginning. And then it's the, you know, the factors of like what kind of trauma you have as a kid or what types of environment that you work in. You know, I always say like we're an Irish family with a drinking problem and everybody laughs. So it kind of means that deep down inside, we already understand genetic predisposition, right? We already understand like on a certain level why that is. But we don't, when it comes time to people wanting to get help, it really becomes about like, great, here's how I did it. Here's how we do it. Here are the 12 steps. You got to follow them. If you can't do it, you're out. And for me, that was not the pathway, even though I love going to meetings and I still go to this day. But for me, the idea of science and also doing it with joy and doing it around comedy, I think really made a difference. I grew up in the 80s, so I have like so many after school specials or so many very special episodes of somebody struggling, which just taught you that like when you're struggling, you are very different and you're not part of the regular episode and it's not fun and light music plays underneath you while you struggle. And so to be able to talk about it in a joyful way and to be able to talk about science, to be able to say that, you know, it's not a moral failing at all. I use the example all the time of peanuts. You know, we've conquered peanuts in 4 years. If I go on a Delta flight and I say I have a peanut allergy, they'll pull every peanut off that flight. And the difference is we don't think that having a peanut allergy is having a moral failing. We just understand that some people, and it's very serious, can become very ill while having it. And so we're all there for them. I was at a conference recently. They pulled every peanut out of that conference. But when it comes to addiction, we don't handle it the same way.
And pull the shrimp while you're at it.
That's right. That's right. Could be.
And there's hundreds of things now that people, you know, lactose. Nope. Get a glass of milk near someone. That's the beauty of science, is that facilities use the science and they teach it. But one of the issues that you've discovered, as she's discovered, I've discovered, is not that many people actually like science. It's not like playing soccer in school or playing football, as many of us do, and enjoy it sort of communally. Science is like a tiny fraction of people want to know molecules, huh? And there's these ions. And yeah, it's a tiny bunch. So it's really hard to get sort of a mass of people on board with tetrahydroisoquinoline and the brain and the enzymes and the reactions and then your body and the... It's just, it's tough. So that you acknowledge that, I think it can help people, because that moral failing is the part that everybody who comes into recovery believes about themselves. Why? Because they were naughty out there and people said things to them. And so it feels so true. And then we find out, as is in the early literature in programs like AA, it talks about this bodily allergy towards something. And this was theoretical. This was a doctor back in the 1930s who said, you know, studying this, it really mimics regular allergies. And here we find it's a medical condition.
Well, listen, if you've ever tried to give a pill to a dog or a cat, you will very quickly understand that the best way to do that is to wrap it in something that they are excited to have.
Yes. Yes.
So to your point about science, like, yes, if we just came out with a TED talk about science, I'm not sure who's coming to that. But that's why the great thing about comedy is that it opens us up. And even, you know, I don't understand a world without comedy. Even at the world's worst funerals, you're just kind of waiting for someone to say something ridiculous so that everyone can laugh. Or you're so looking forward to that first laugh that a group can have because we're desperate for it. And I think we really miss conversations when we don't add comedy into it, or when we try to your point, just try to focus on that moral failing aspect, which just makes you feel bad and just makes you feel like you are the one person that can't get it, or you relapse. And so you assume like, great, I guess it just isn't going to work out for me. And how many times do you relapse before you just kind of give up on the whole thing? So,
you know,
for me,
Sean Daniels, to your point, back, this is maybe 15 years ago, more people got their hard news from Comedy Central than all the networks combined, because the Comedy Central, and I believe it was the Daily Show at the time when Jon Stewart was at the helm and Colbert was doing his crazy satirical moments, they were actually covering like the news. And the news was covering the Kardashians. And that's so people were like hungry for stuff. But if you laugh your way through stuff that's difficult, you can actually absorb it. Like you said, it becomes edible, as when you give the pill to the dog, you wrap it in, say, brie cheese.
And
you give it to the poodle. Woo!
Yeah. No, I think that's it. So we had this amazing thing that happened in the show in New York, is that after every performance, somebody would come up and say, okay, I'm ready to get help. And actually, at the very first performance we did, somebody came up and said, I'm an alcoholic, but I'm not sober right now. And we said, like, okay, that's great. And so we started putting tools together. And that person reached out after 3 weeks to say to us, like, thank you all so much. I have 21 days today. And so the question was often like, why, why is the last thing you do before you get sober, like, attend a play? That doesn't feel like the list of like things that you would normally do. And what we've come to realize is like, oh, because it's funny, because it's a group thing. It's a very like light way to dip your toe into the recovery. I know when I went to my first AA meeting, I was terrified that everyone there would know I was an alcoholic, even though they were there for the exact same reason I was, and I was. But it allows them to really kind of, you know, just watch, just be a part of it, and at the end, kind of make a choice whether that they want to get help or not. And I feel like that shows right there. And you know, like, theater is such a strange and small thing. It's like a certain amount of people in one town at one time a day. And so if we're getting one person, a performance, getting ready to step forward, that shows how many people there are that are ready to get help if we can get them this message.
Sean, there's a theme in the play. More will be revealed. And if you're in recovery, if you do 12-step support group meetings, you've most likely heard that saying, which is talking about taking your recovery one day at a time. How do you think this principle has shaped your journey, and what message does it send to people that are struggling with addiction or alcoholism?
So one day at a time, and more will be revealed, is like something I find myself saying all the time because it works for everything. You know, I have a 5-year-old, right? And it's just like, how are we gonna possibly ever get her to eat something besides mac and cheese? And it's like, all right, well, let's just focus on today. Let's just try to get a few strawberries in there today and we'll see how it goes. And it's, what's a great thing is that, you know, as an addict, like, I would like to know everything and I'd like to know it now. And I'd like to be able to control all those things, but that doesn't seem to be able to work out. So the idea of just taking it one day at a time, there's a really funny, when I was in rehab, they were talking about, you know, that you can't ever drink again. And some woman said, like, are you telling me I can't drink champagne at my daughter's wedding? And as soon as she said that, her friend was like, you don't even have a boyfriend. And it was like the funniest thing ever to me, because it shows what addicts do, where it's like, we're already playing it way out in the future to figure out how we are going to be either offended or we can't do something. And it's like, you don't have to worry about that right now.
Just, and then the addict will defend it by saying, I'm planning ahead.
That's right. That's right. And so it's such a great lesson, you know, in terms of how, you know, like, just how do you handle these things? And especially, you know, with the show, we just had this great run off Broadway and we have all this interest about, you know, is it going to move to Broadway? Is it going to move to London? And so all we can do at that moment, and this is just a practical thing, is like one day at a time, we'll try to move the show forward. We'll try to talk to the right people. We'll see what happens. And it kind of frees you of that idea that, like, you have to know everything and you have to control everything. And that, of course, just leads to, you know, disappointment, which leads to resentment, which is like the number one reason that leads you to relapse. So it's definitely something that we say all the time. In fact, I just said it to my wife last night, because we're always just trying to remind ourselves that, like, we're just taking it one day at a time, and we'll understand more when we understand it.
Sean Daniels, we're dealing in these times now where a lot of celebrities are falling. We're watching it happen. People are more clued in on you know, what's going on, alcoholism, drug addiction, hardly a stranger. We've got half the Midwest, plenty of places in the South where the opioid epidemic is, epidemic would be the polite word for it. So reflecting on the recent passing of, say, actor Matthew Perry, which became national news for weeks, how do you think the conversation around relapse needs to evolve in society?
Well, I think that, you know, it's hard to know what are the key moments in a movement while you're in the middle of it. But I think the passing of Matthew Perry will eventually be one of the great things that we see help to change national narratives. Like we talked about Ellen coming out for gay marriage, yeah. because, you know, Matthew Perry passed away and people knew him. They felt like they knew him and they knew that he struggled. And, you know, there wasn't like a flock of people that came out afterwards talking about how he abused them on the set. It was like, no, he genuinely loved and just struggled with this. And if you grew up watching him on TV, I think that you suddenly realize actually what addiction is, and that it's not just, you know, people that make bad choices, that it happens to people. And so I wrote this article in the LA Times about relapse, and they just told me that it passed for them about 170,000 people had read it so far. And the idea was that that we have to stop being so negative about relapsing. Because actually what I clocked at the moment was Matthew Perry passed away, and even my sober friends were like, well, let's wait till we find out what he passed away from before we talk too much about it. As though the idea would be that if he had relapsed and passed away, then none of the work that he had done as a sober person would have meant anything. And that is straight up just internalized shame that we have all added to ourselves. I mean, that's coming from inside the community. And so we talk a lot about if you were driving a car across the country and it broke down, would you get it fixed and then go back to the beginning of your trip to start again? No, you would just pick up from where you were and you would go on. And relapse is the same thing. That why if you were doing it, you know, you've learned so much. It took me a year and a half to get 90 days, and I still think of it that way. And how I should think about it is that for a year and a half, I was working and learning, and I'm probably still alive today because of some of those 70-day stints. And every time that I screwed up, I learned, like, okay, well, actually, don't get too cocky, because sometimes I relapsed because things were going well, and I hadn't expected that. Or I relapse because, you know, something personal happens and you're not prepared for it. And I just think the conversation around relapse is so that if you do it, you're starting over. It's day zero. You've got to get back on it. And in reality, that's not the case. I have so many friends who are cancer survivors. Mm. And if they got cancer again, we wouldn't be like, well, that last time that you beat cancer, that actually wasn't a thing. Now you have to beat it this time, right? Of course, we understand, like, that would be cruel. We just say, like, oh my God, I'm so sorry that it's back. But, like, we know how to fight this thing now. Now we know what it is. We have those things in place. And I think that's the conversation around addiction, that even we in our own industry are quick to turn our back on whatever time existed where that person was sober.
I think also people get afraid if you're in a group, a recovery group with other people, and you've known them for a long time, and somebody falls, has a relapse, it terrifies everyone in the room because you remember that could happen to you. And so people get very emotional and they get confused about what has actually happened. What does it mean? Is it communicable, like a disease, that kind of, yeah, really?
Like, yeah, no, yeah. I'm terrified. Somebody says, like, oh, there was a person in my group and they had 25 years and then they went back out and it took them 2 years to get back in the room. And I'm terrified. But that's just about me, right? That's just about, like, on the list of things I'm worried I can't control, there may in fact be one more, or that I have to stay vigilant, right? Or that I'm not just fixed and now I can do whatever it is I want, that I have to stay on it and I have to figure out, what is it that keeps me sober and how do I continue to work on it? And, you know, for me, the joke is, but it's true, right? That if you, like, sponsor somebody or you work with them, it's really the most selfish thing that you could do. Because you spend any time with them and you think, oh my God, you don't look good, sir. I do not want to be where you are again, right? And they think, like, why are you spending all this time, like, helping me and chatting me through and getting it there? And it's like, actually, I'm doing it for me. because as I look at you, I think like I would be, if I'm lucky, I'd be where you are if I went back out. And that may not actually be the case. And so, you know, for us when we did the show and every night when somebody came up and we'd talk to them, you know, you kind of forget what it looks like, the terror in their eyes, the, you know, they're like a little sweaty, they're a little out of it. They're telling you about their, you know, their partner is moving out of the apartment right now and just all the, that wreckage that comes with it. And so it reminds me at that moment, like, right, well, then I have to keep doing what I'm doing to make sure that I don't end up there.
Let's end Sean Daniels with maybe some thoughts or advice that you might give to any of us struggling with addiction and seeking a way forward in that recovery journey. You know, the dance steps that have worked for you. What thoughts do you have on what people, how people might pull this thing off?
So I think a lot about, you know, whatever you think of AA meetings, right? Think about this, that people go, you sit in a basement with strangers and you tell your story, and then a good chunk of those people don't die. And so why does that work, right? That's not diet or science or pills or exercise. Like, why does that keep people alive? And I think it's really because the opposite of addiction is not abstinence, it's community. It's gathering with other people, it's working with them. Every addict I know, probably all of them, at some point as it got worse and worse, they shrunk the community that they had. They spent less and less time with other people. Like your disease wants you to be alone. It wants, you know, for me, it's like I was drunk watching TV at 4 a.m. alone, because that's the best time I could drink and nobody would judge me. And that's that. Those are not highlights. And so I think just reminding people that if the answer is community, like you have to be brave and you have to tell other people and you have to reach out to people in recovery and you have to look up online, like what meetings there are and go to one and you have to raise your hand, and it's awful and it's embarrassing, but you have to build that community, because that community, those people are ready for you. If you've ever been in a meeting where there's a newcomer, like they couldn't be happier, you know, because they, you know, everybody loves to give advice and it's like the time to do it. But if you're that newcomer, suddenly you have phone numbers and you have people contact you and they're excited to have you back. And I just think, you know, modern TV doesn't portray recovery rooms in an accurate way. And talking about comedy, you go to those meetings and people roar with laughter. People tell horrific stories. And then the room laughs because people recognize that behavior. And it's not the sad, you know, six people chanting your name that TV has told you. It's really, it can be a ton of fun. And I just feel like that's the community that if you want to get sober or clean, like those people are, they're ready for you.
Yeah. And for over 80 years, people have been coming voluntarily by the tens of millions because they love that life that they finally got back. Sean Daniels is a playwright, recovering addict who uses comedy on stage to tackle addiction and stigma. He's been sharing with us his journey from alcoholism to sobriety through this play, The White Chip, a now very famous play that is being called by London and other places to go around the world. He directs the Recovery Project at Florida Studio Theater, and he aims to change the narrative around recovery using the power of the arts. You can learn more at SeanDaniels.com, Sean, S-E-A-N. Yep, S-E-A-N, Daniels.com. Thank you, Sean, for joining us today.
Great, thank you.
You can tweet us anytime on X, at Reboot Your Life.
Riverside Recovery of Tampa was created to offer state-of-the-art treatment options to people suffering from addiction. The model was developed to meet clients and their families where they are at and provide them with the tools and education needed so that they can achieve long-term recovery. No two people are the same, and no two people have the same experience with addiction, and it is for this reason that we tailor each treatment plan to the unique needs of each individual. Located alongside the Hillsborough River in the heart of Tampa, Riverside Recovery offers the full continuum of care, and what that means is that we offer medical detoxification, residential care, day treatment, intensive outpatient, and outpatient levels of care. If you or someone you know needs help and are ready to seek treatment, call Riverside Recovery of Tampa at 1-800-871-5440. That's 800-871-5440. You can learn more about the treatment we provide at rrtampa.com. Again, that's rrtampa.com.
Learn more at rrtampa.com.
Reboot your life. From the Sunshine State, this is Tampa Bay's 10 Talk.